John Sayles' 1987 film, Meitwan, is a dramatic retelling of the circumstances surrounding the 1920 Battle of Meitwan, or Meitwan Massacre, one of the first of several armed struggles between workers and mercenaries working for the coal companies in the hills of West Virginia. It stars Chris Cooper as Joe Kenahan, an organizer from United Mine Workers, who arrives by train in Meitwan in the middle of an incipient strike by local miners facing wage cuts and price hikes by the company who practically owns the town, Stone Mountain. The train he is on is carrying would-be African-American and Italian miners in a freight car in back, unwittingly brought in to break the strike. One of them, a genial but commanding man named Few Clothes, played by James Earl Jones, later helps to unite the African-American contingent and the local miners. Joe finds a place to stay with miner widow Elma Radner, played by Mary McDonnell. Her son Danny, played by a 17-year-old Will Oldham, is a miner, a unionist, and an aspiring preacher. He immediately takes to Joe and more than once uses his time at the pulpit to sermonize about labor struggles through the register of Bible stories. At a secret miner meeting, Joe argues against the violent exhortations of a company spy named C.E. Lively, played by Bob Gunton. After Few Clothes shows up saying he wants to join the union, Joe convinces the white locals to bring the strike breakers into the union, which adds strength to the strike and motivates the company to send in hired mercenaries of the Baldwin Felts Agency. As the Baldwins try to take over the town by gun, they are thwarted by the pro-union local lawman Sid Hatfield, played by David Strathern, and the mayor. After a failed attempt by the company spy to ruin Joe's reputation by framing him as a rapist, gives the organizing efforts a further boost, reinforcements show up to evict strikers whether the town leaders like it or not. The murder of a teenage miner draws Sid, the mayor, and all the town's gun-wielding miners into the infamous Meitwan Massacre that left more company men than miners dead. There's a lot going on in this film, Jan, but I had the idea to suggest this when in the last week the West Virginia teachers' strike concluded, and there is a lot of reflection about West Virginia history. And we also know that shortly after Donald Trump was elected, there was a lot made out of the reactionary history of West Virginia and the essentially conservative culture of West Virginians. And there's a lot of struggle around how that history accurately reflects these, you know, historic battles between miners and companies.
Yeah, there are different stories of coal miners that have circulated in the culture, and John Sayles himself said in traveling through West Virginia this idea of making the film of Meitwan because he was so impressed and moved by a certain dignity and stoicism in that part of the country, what he described as resignation about how dark and dirty and cold and wet and dangerous it was, and the pride that they were the people to do it and do it well. That's a quote from John Sayles. And economist Paul Krugman turned to the history of the coal miners after the 2016 election and wrote about the symbolism of coal mining in Appalachia and in the larger American narratives of manhood, and how ironic it was that Donald Trump won overwhelming support in West Virginia, even though that state has lost and never will regain the coal industry as it was 50 years ago. He said, quote, "Donald Trump successfully pandered to cultural nostalgia, to a longing for a vanished past when men were men and miners dug deep," unquote. And I think it would be good to talk about that role of nostalgia and how you represent this history that's been so repressed in terms of the militancy of it and its importance in the larger struggle of unionism and the potential on the left as well to romanticize that period. What's your take on Meitwan and whether Sayles did romanticize that period that was based on a historic coal miner strike in West Virginia?
Well, I think that depends on what you mean by nostalgia. There's a lot of history behind the events in this movie, and the way that he decides to tell this story is both trying to report that history, but then also, I think, interrupt what from his own perspective are the problems of the history of labor in this country. Some of that has to do with masculinity and especially its tendency towards a certain kind of force and violence, especially around guns. But even the idea of the industrial workers of the world, which shows up very early in this movie as a internal reference to nostalgia, where he says, "I ran with the Wobblies," and this other miner says, "Yeah, I did too, back when that meant something." And there's this sense of, in the film, it's worked through, you know, what does our memory do for us as far as moving forward?
And the film opens with a very compelling scene of a miner with a mining axe, and during a period when coal was more easily mined on one level, but then you see just this palpable closeness and enclosure of the mine itself and digging for coal, and you hear this cough, the cough of the coal miner, and this sense of the tremendous physical vulnerability of these men, and even the pacifism, I think, of the lead character, the heroic character who refused to fight with guns, suggests, I think you're right, a different vision of masculinity. There's a lot about the vulnerability of men. It challenges the fantasy of an earlier muscular manhood that Trump plays off of the proud coal miner, and usually as a defender of a very small circle of people, his family, versus the struggles here of finding common ground. And I guess you could say that is part of what makes it forward-looking rather than nostalgic, in the sense of trying to recover a bygone era that's never going to return, that it does take up some of what's difficult in people coming together, although, you know, maybe it oversimplified some of that idea of one big union.
Yeah, that's part of what Joe Kinahan's character is channeling, is maybe naivete is a word we might use to describe this vision of a nonviolent labor movement. Though the IWW itself was often cast as this like extreme terroristic organization, and the word sabotage suggests like a violent destruction of equipment or something along those lines, when in the IWW's own history, they adamantly said, no, our idea of sabotage has to do with our capacity to labor and the withdrawal of labor power, and that is sabotaging the machine. And that tension is at the heart of the labor movement long before even the events of Mate 1.
Yeah, I think it'd be good to talk some about the rape story in the film in Mate 1 that becomes a kind of test of how much movement could be divided around this story meant to discredit Kinahan, who was a leftist come in as an organizer, so he was somewhat of an outsider, but was he in this community or not? And the way in which he was set up to be defeated on the basis of a charge he had raped this woman. And she had been manipulated politically to promote a false story that he had raped her. And I think it does raise some interesting questions that I think some feminists would not like that scene, because she was giving a false story to discredit a man. So it's much more a story about competing visions of honor among men than it was a woman's story. But it did, I think, draw out how much rape stories have been part of the political currency of our history. Certainly black men being falsely accused, men being accused to serve some other purpose among, you know, struggles among men. I think there was also in that scene and other scenes where there's some question of Joe Kinahan attracting women coming into town, there's some of the conventions of the Western where the righteous cowboy comes into town. He has some seductive interactions with women, but he remains very single and unattached. This is Jan Hawken and Joe Clement talking today about John Sayles' important film of the 1980s, Mate 1. Well, Joe, we were talking earlier about this distinction between nostalgia as a conservative, kind of politically regressive, we might say, emotion or sentiment versus reclaiming forgotten history and what we might call social memory, the importance of recovering the parts of our past that have been denied or repressed in the larger culture. So what about some of that memory of the painful divisions that have been part of the union movement? That did the film make too easy the process of overcoming the conflicts between white workers seeing a train load of scabs being brought in who are black workers, and how that the bitterness of that part of our racialized history, and also immigrants or Italian workers. And there were a number of places where the music, they played different music, but it achieved a kind of harmony pretty quickly. What about that, the promise of harmony too quickly? Does a film suffer from that form of romanticizing?
Well, there's only so much that you can fit into a movie, and John Sayles' point, I think, is essentially true, which is that solidarity across racial lines is what made the union movement successful and what will make it successful. Today, what we need to look for as far as success in the labor movement is also unity across industrial or occupational lines, such as we saw in the West Virginia teacher strike, which was really probably more accurately described as a public worker strike led by teachers, because there were many other job classifications that participated. And it is a large part of why we're even talking about this film today.
Yeah, and I think the teacher's strike also defied many of the stereotypes that circulate in this country of hill people, Appalachians as backward, frozen in time. And many of them thrived even in liberal or circulating in liberal political discourse out of the outrage about how popular Trump was and how in West Virginia, and how these are the very people that depend so heavily on the federal government and support through government programs, who bought into this line about being independent of the government. And so I think this is a kind of redemptive moment for West Virginia and these young people, or the generations that followed the miners, most of whom are very old and infirmed. The survivors have children who carry this long memory of the miner struggles, and some of the signifiers were on display during the strike.
Well, and many of these institutions are themselves just generational in how they're operated. Your grandpa was a miner, you are, or your grandfather was a teacher and now you are, or someone worked in the school and now you do. There's more than just a story there. There is an actual practical, like, interest that goes across the generations, holding down these important institutions like the schools.
And most of the employment in West Virginia is not in the mines. It's a very small percentage of the workforce there. And so teachers, healthcare workers, public sector workers are not only an important part of employment, but it is an area where people can come together around a common vision of the collective good.
Yeah, I think it's important, again, to stress how teachers won a raise for all state workers. And that is itself a victory against a very popular anti-union narrative, which is that union workers of whatever occupation we're identifying as the union, the teachers' union in this case, are trying to secure benefits and their interests at the expense of other workers, or that there is this competition among public workers because they all draw from the same budget. And that was part of the governor and the legislature's kind of rhetorical play against the unions when they conceded, was that, okay, we'll give you this raise, but it's going to come out of the hide of all of these other vulnerable populations. And that is yet to be materialized. And it was one of the teachers' planks that this funding come from some other source, their suggestion being the natural gas industry that is starting to supplant the coal industry as the fossil fuel profit engine there.
And these are also people who've lived with the healthcare effects of massive deregulation that preceded even the Trump administration's intensifying of deregulation of the coal industry, and see the reality of the effects over time of the health issues, environmental issues, as well as loss of employment associated with this right-wing agenda. So Mate One is a very timely film, and John Sayles, a left-wing filmmaker of considerable note for other works, has written a book about the making of the film, and that's also, I think, worth taking a look at. And you can get the DVD. It's not available video on demand, but and it is available at one or two places in Portland. It is available at the public library and also at Clinton Street Video, one of the few remaining video stores, independent video stores in town.
Yeah, that book is called Thinking in Pictures, The Making of the Movie Mate One. You can get that at the library. I actually have the copy right here, so you should put it on
back.
Hold. This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hawken talking about John Sayles' 1987 film Mate One for the Old Mole Variety Hour.